This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the U.S. has been really exemplary in the way it has welcomed to its shores some of those people who have been at most risk and at most danger of being persecuted or indeed killed.
That's Leonard Doyle of the International Organization for Migration. He says the U.S. resettlement program is one of the most important in the world. Details coming up.
Also, the AU expresses disappointment in the Trump administration's immigration policy, and no relief from drought is in sight for the Horn of Africa. A UN agency warns close to 17 million people in the region are affected.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, two UN agencies say they will continue to actively engage with the U.S. to help refugees who need protection and to offer support on asylum and migration matters. The International Organization for Migration and the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, have issued a joint statement regarding the Trump administration's refugee policy. They say the needs of refugees and migrants have never been greater. Leonard Doyle is a spokesperson for the IOM from Geneva. He told VOA's Jody Capua that the U.S. resettlement program is one of the most important in the world.
Well, indeed, because it's traditionally been so extraordinarily generous to some of the most vulnerable people on the planet. So we're not talking about all refugees, which is about 23 million thereabouts. We're talking about a tiny percentage. And the U.S. has been really exemplary in the way it has welcomed to its shores some of those people who have been at most risk and at most danger of being persecuted or indeed killed. Irrespective of religion, irrespective of ethnicity, irrespective of what part of the world they come from. And this really we see as a beacon in the world and it's something which we, of course, would like to see continue.
So what is the IOM and UNHCR doing at this point to engage the U.S. regarding the refugee policy?
I think at the present time what we're really trying to do is help those refugees who thought they were about to get on the plane in the next couple of weeks and months and start a new life, to help them cope with what is happening for them individually as families. Because if you think about it, many had moved from desperate situations in refugee camps. They'd gone through a long, long process of security clearance, health checks, cultural orientation, so they learn about the new society that they're going to. And as far as they were concerned, their number was coming up and they were about to leave at any minute. So that's now on hold for the vast majority of them, for about 19,000. So unfortunately, they have to go back now to the camps where they've probably lost the spot, lost the humble shelter or home that they've had. They've lost their ration cards. They've lost their livelihoods because, of course, they work in these camps. That's really what our focus is on now, trying to kind of support these very vulnerable people, many of whom are medical cases that need urgent treatment.
That sounds like a very, very big job. Where do you begin trying to resettle those you already had resettled?
Well, you put your finger on an important aspect of this, is that because the U.S. is the most important, in many respects, the most generous in the resettlement issue, it does not mean it should be the only one. And this is obviously an extraordinary opportunity for other countries now to step forward. One thing to be critical or to make political capital out of this, but I think the reality is these are vulnerable people. And while the U.S. is going through this review or this reset for the next 120 days, it's an excellent opportunity for other countries to step forward, which they've not actually done.
Would you explain that? Which countries do you feel should be taking in more refugees at this stage?
Well, it's certainly not for us to point the finger at individual countries. But we of course, know that Canada has been extraordinarily generous and indeed has offered to take many of those who are stuck or are somehow in limbo. But there are plenty of other countries. Let's look at what globalization has done to the planet over the last 10, 20 years. It's brought economic improvement and wealth to vast areas of the world. Indeed, countries that not too long ago were considered to be beneficiaries of aid are now countries that are moving rapidly up the value chain in terms of income and in terms of quality of life. And these are diverse countries, many of them in the global south, and there surely is space there for people, especially these people who are in such peril, actually. So we're talking about the resurgent economies of Asia. We're talking about Latin America. We're talking about many countries in Europe. I mean, there is no shortage of countries where there's room for refugees at the bottom line.
You say that they can enrich societies. How so?
Well, I think they enrich societies in two ways. One is that the generosity of a country in bringing a vulnerable refugee for resettlement is rescuing somebody from mortal danger in many cases. And then secondly, when that refugee family or refugee comes to a country, I mean, their gratitude is extraordinary. Their willingness to adapt, their willingness to work and to contribute to their new society, and indeed to bring richness to that new society by what they're bringing with them, is extraordinary. So we consider it to be a double victory when you accept a family of refugees for resettlement.
Leonard Doyle is a spokesperson for the International Organization for Migration. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
European leaders are reacting to President Donald Trump's executive order that includes the suspension of entry into the U.S. by some foreign nationals. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me from Rome about what some of Europe's leaders are saying as they continue to deal with the migrant and refugee crisis.
Well, there has been a very strong reaction from the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She attacked the travel ban, saying that the decisive battle against terrorism does not justify putting people of a particular background or faith under general suspicion. So a strong reaction there, even though she herself is facing a lot more criticism these days because of her compassionate approach to migrants and allowing thousands of migrants to transferred to Germany over the last couple of years.
France's president, François Hollande, has also had some reaction regarding President Trump's executive order.
Yes, President François Hollande has called on European leaders to give a very firm response to this decision by Donald Trump. It's raised a lot of concern in France and in other European countries. The French Foreign Minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, he said on Sunday that accepting refugees was a duty of solidarity, and terrorism had no nationality. He stressed that discrimination was not the right response. Quite interesting, given that they have had their own experience of terrorism attacks in the last couple of years.
And also, the UK's foreign minister made a statement as well.
The Prime Minister, Theresa May, was reluctant to take a stance, saying that it was up to the US to decide its own policy. But the Foreign Minister, Boris Johnson, made a very strong statement on Twitter saying, "We will protect the rights and freedoms of UK nationals," referring to those that may have been caught up in the drama at the US airports. He said it was divisive and wrong to stigmatize people because of their nationality.
In Italy, I understand there's been actually some mixed reaction.
Well, the Interior Minister warned mixing immigration and terrorism, saying it was wrong and unacceptable to put the two together, and also stressed that treating immigrants as some kind of security risk was counterproductive and led to social exclusion. The Prime Minister, Paolo Gentiloni, said Italy was built on its values. In his particular tweet, he didn't refer to what Mr. Trump said in particular, but he tweeted that Italy was an open, pluralistic society with no discrimination, and that was a pillar of European societies. Other politicians in Italy called for stronger condemnation of President Trump's ban. The Speaker of the House of Parliament said it was unmistakable and alarming sign, whereas the leader of Italy's far-right anti-immigrant Northern League, Matteo Salvini, praised the ban, retweeting a statement by President Trump. And he said that what was happening in Europe was a horrible mess, and referred to the mass migration, the crisis that we're seeing in Italy, as an invasion. So strong words there from the far-right Northern League leader, Matteo Salvini.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
The UN Secretary General has commended African countries for opening their borders to refugees and people fleeing violence while other parts of the world. The Associated Press reports Antonio Guterres made the remarks today in Addis Ababa, where several dozen African leaders are attending the African Union. He says that African nations are among the world's largest and most generous hosts of refugees. He adds that African borders remain open for those in need of protection when so many borders are being closed, even in the most developed countries in the world.
And Libya's Coast Guard has detained 700 mostly North African migrants after intercepting two boats just a few kilometers from shore. Libyan guards took fire from some of the migrants or their smugglers, but no one was injured in the gunfight just 70 kilometers west of Tripoli. The migrants were likely headed to Italy. In the past 3 days, the Italian Coast Guard has rescued more than 1,300 migrants and recovered three bodies. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Two UN agencies say they'll continue to engage with the U.S. government to help migrants and refugees most in need. And little or no rain is expected, has stricken the Horn of Africa. A UN agency warns close to 17 million people in the region are affected. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
There's no relief from drought in sight for the Horn of Africa. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization warns little, if any, rain is expected in the coming months. More than 17 million people in the region are already listed as being in crisis and emergency food insecurity. The rains that should come between October and December failed, causing major problems in Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, Kenya, South Sudan, Sudan, and Uganda. The FAO says the next rains are not expected for at least 2 months. It says they are crucial for a successful harvest in July.
Zimbabwe is experiencing a shortage of ammonium nitrate at a crucial time when most crops need fertilizer. This poses a serious obstacle to a successful harvest season. Kudze Zvanshi spoke to Zimbabwe Farmers Commercial Union President Wanda Chabakwa, who explains about the situation.
For many Zimbabwe farmers, rains this season have been good, but not the supplies of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, also known as AN. Zimbabwe Farmers Commercial Union President Wanda Chabakwa explains the situation.
This agricultural season, as of many seasons, it has been a very wet season, and the demand for fertilizers, starting with the compound D, was very high. Now followed by AN is very high. The demand has actually been increased by the program introduced by government, special maize program.
The rainy season, coupled by a government program promoting the farming of maize, has caused the escalating demand for fertilizer. The idea behind the boost in maize production is to make the country self-sufficient. The scheme has been well received by farmers, resulting in large tracts of idle land being cultivated this season. Chabakwa says fertilizer companies were not prepared.
Our fertilizer companies, particularly the local fertilizer manufacturers, it looks like they did not anticipate that kind of demand, although they are aware of what was required, because figures were given. If we talk about you want to grow 400,000 hectares, they were supposed to have known from that figure how much compound D, how much top dressing fertilizer was supposed to be on hand.
Chabakwa says the fertilizer companies have a different point of view.
Although on engaging them, we hear they are saying, yes, they thought they had capacity, but they say their challenges was with foreign currents to import critical raw materials. Whether that is true or not, we don't know.
Fertilizer industry spokesperson Mishek Kachere declined to comment on the matter, referring this reporter to the fertilizer companies. Chabakwa reflects on what could have been done to avert this.
But I believe also as a nation, we should have made provisions to import from countries where we know there are other countries whose cost of production is much lower, and where fertilizer can actually land in this country at a much lower price than we can priced when it is manufactured locally.
Tabikwa says other factors can affect productivity. For example, for some, good rains has meant flooding and soil erosion.
Where normally we have a negative effect on yields in such a wet season is on our sandy soils. Because of these recent rains, high rainfall, normally we suffer what we call leaching, where nutrients are washed down the soil profile to levels beyond the reach of the crops. And this is the major challenge that we have.
Food production is also affected by pests like the so-called four armworm. Fertilizer shortage, beefed up by the entry of an alien pest, has not made this any easy.
It's a worm that is more sophisticated and is bigger than the traditional stock borer that we have had over the years, that we are used to, that where our researchers found chemicals control it. It has never been a major problem. This year, the four armworm has been a big problem. It is affecting maize only, and it's going into the funnels of the maize crops. And it just has taken us by surprise. It's a worm that is more sophisticated and is bigger than the traditional stock borer that we have had over the years, that we are used to, that where our researchers found chemicals control it. It has never been a major problem. This year, the four armworm has been a big problem. It is affecting maize only, and it's going into the funnels of the maize crops. And it just has taken us by surprise.
Tabikwa says the most affected were the early crops, though the situation has improved. In spite of all these factors, he believes this year will be a good harvest, though there could still be shortages. This is Kudzai Nawashe reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
January 2011, the Tunisian people were able to peacefully remove their oppressive ruler, sparking what was named the Arab Spring. A few days later, tens of thousands of Egyptians gathered in Thrier Square for 18 days for an end to the 30-year rule of President Hosni Mubarak. But what appeared to be an opening for democratic transition in Egypt faded, and the country is perceived to be on shaky ground financially. Michelle Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi about the ups and downs of the Arab Spring in both Egypt and Tunisia.
Egypt had a very brief democratic political opening. It opened and closed very, very quickly. I do think it has left some lasting effects on the society, and that ultimately Egyptians are going to ask more from their government than they did before 2011. But they face some very steep obstacles now because the military coup of 2013 and the military-dominated government that has been in power since then has really tried to reconstruct the wall of fear and even build it higher than it was under Mubarak to really increase the obstacles against any kind of protest or even criticism of the government. But Egypt has a very young and dynamic society with under now very, very difficult economic conditions, and I would expect that ultimately there will be more moves from Egyptian society to demand better governance.
It was Tunisia who sparked the so-called Arab Spring. What did work in Tunisia 6 years after its revolution?
Tunisia had, I think, a remarkable political success. Tunisians undertook a long roundtable process and then held elections and wrote a new constitution. So Tunisia has reconstructed its political order based on a pretty broad consensus. That was a big success. But unfortunately, that success has not yet been translated into the economic realm. Tunisia still has strong underdevelopment in many of its regions, very high unemployment, very high youth unemployment, and Tunisians have yet to work out the kind of consensus on economic issues that they did on political issues. They also need to decentralize government. Tunisia had a very centralized government, and that meant that decisions taken at a local level often didn't make sense, which is one of the reasons for economic lack of development in many areas. The Tunisian constitution calls for decentralization, but they really haven't gotten around to it yet. They keep postponing local elections and so forth. The political parties simply are not ready for that. And so that's a balancing act, but that's, I think, someplace Tunisians know they need to go in order to really start making decisions at the local level that can drive economic development.
Why was Tunisian revolution considered mostly successful while Egypt did not achieve the goals of its revolution?
Well, Tunisia had a different situation from Egypt. Tunisia as a country in the big picture had some assets that Egypt didn't have. They had a higher level in general of education, of women's empowerment. It's a wealthier country, smaller population. It has a lot of problems, but the problems are not as overwhelming as the problems of Egypt. Also, Tunisia didn't have an overwhelming power like the Egyptian military that has really tried to dominate the political scene and to be the key political decision makers. And also within the political scene, the Tunisian political spectrum was more pluralist and diverse than the Egyptian political spectrum. So within Egypt, a political opening led very quickly to a power struggle between the military on the one hand and Islamists on the other hand.
That's Michelle Dunn, director of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host, Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, the 28th African Union Summit, voting for a new leader, discussing the re-entry of Morocco, and mapping the future of the continent. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Yes, sir. Two-Face.
NATO C. Hey. Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. every day, right here on VOA Africa.